Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. A conversation with Anita Hill coming up. But first, 100 or so masked protesters smashed windows, threw stones at police, and attempted to block a highway leading into the G8 summit of world leaders, which begins today in Scotland. As protests continue, the leaders of Britain, France, Germany, Russia, Japan, Canada, Italy, and the U.S. dine with the Queen tonight, protected by a 6-foot-high perimeter fence surrounding the exclusive and remote Glen Eagles Hotel. Over 3 days of talk, the leaders of the Group of Eight industrialized nations hope to come to some agreement on aid to Africa and global warming. But on his way to the meeting, President Bush, who turns 59 today, once again made it clear he will not join the rest of the G8 in signing the 1997 Kyoto Protocol to reduce greenhouse gases.
I think there's a better way forward. I would call it the post-Kyoto era, where we can work together to share technologies, to control greenhouse gases as best as possible.
Well, joining us on the line from Scotland, Larry Elliott, correspondent for The Guardian newspaper of London. And Larry, you write today that draft communiques issued at these summits are usually written well in advance, but that's not the case this time.
No, that's not been the case this time. It's been very unusual. It's the first time in about 10 years or more that actually discussions and negotiations have gone on right up to the summit itself, and I think they'll continue into the summit period. Mm.
Well, and the summit leaders have already come to some agreement on increasing aid to Africa and canceling the debt of poorer nations. But on global warming, they remain far apart. You write that the U.S. position has hardened even more. Now, we wondered about that because we thought President Bush, in an interview Monday on British television, made quite a concession for him, acknowledging that global warming is partly caused by human activity.
Well, I think that there'll be some words in the communique about global warming, but I think the concessions that the U.S. have made are fairly cosmetic. The big White House sticking point on Kyoto is that it didn't include countries like China and India, and that if the U.S. did sign up, it would put itself at an economic disadvantage to those countries. But what's being talked about here by people like Tony Blair and Jacques Chirac is some form of post-Kyoto agreement that did include the developing countries, and it seems that President Bush is very, very wary about signing up to that also.
Yeah. Well, you write that other sticking points at the summit include universal access to AIDS treatment. The U.S. is resisting that idea, and also a timetable for phasing out agricultural subsidies. Do you expect the negotiators, they're called Sherpas, we gather, to reach agreement on those two issues?
Well, I think on treatment for HIV AIDS, there was very strong commitment in the communique agreed by finance ministers in London about a month ago, where they said pretty categorically that everybody who'd had HIV/AIDS would have treatment by 2010. Now, the cost of that is enormous. It will run into billions of dollars per year, and I think that the U.S. Sherpas have gone away and said, well, you know, we're unhappy about this sort of unlimited cost. And they tried to get that taken out of the GA communique. And my understanding is that it will be kept in, but there will be, and the Americans want some sort of detailed plan on how the GA expects to pay for that. Mm-hmm. On trade, I think there's been very, very little movement here.
Larry Elliott is a correspondent for The Guardian newspaper. He's at the G8 summit. And I'm wondering, one last question, Larry. How effective do you think Live 8 concert organizer Sir Bob Geldof has been in pushing this issue? Do you think it's going to have any impact on the leaders meeting there, the issue of poverty?
I think he's had an enormous effect. I think that he's mobilized public opinion, and I think that the world leaders have been forced to respond to the pressure that's been put upon them by the public, somewhat reluctantly in a lot of cases, but they are being forced by the pressure of public opinion to act.
The White House and Senate Republican leaders are urging their conservative allies to tone down the rhetoric as the president considers a Supreme Court nominee to replace retiring Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. Abortion opponents have been attacking a possible nominee, Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, for being soft on abortion. And the White House is reportedly hoping to avoid an ugly and divisive nomination process, like the one over Robert Bork, who lost, or Clarence Thomas, who won. At the center of the Thomas battle in 1991 was the then 35-year-old law professor at the University of Oklahoma, Anita Hill. Along with two other women, she said that Thomas, her supervisor a few years earlier at the Department of Education and the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, had harassed her. Unlike the other two women, she was called to testify. A warning, this excerpt, heard around the world, may be too graphic for some.
After a brief discussion of work, he would turn the conversation to a discussion of sexual matters. He spoke about acts that he had seen in pornographic films involving such matters as women having sex with animals and films showing group sex or rape scenes. He talked about pornographic materials depicting individuals with large penises or large breasts involved in various sex acts. On several occasions, Thomas told me graphically of his own sexual prowess.
Clarence Thomas denied Anita Hill's accusations and called the hearings a public lynching. She was excoriated. African Americans accused her of letting her race down. Conservatives labeled her a little nutty and a little slutty. Well, now, as we move into a new, possibly divisive battle, we look at the upcoming hearings through the eyes of someone who's been there. Anita Hill is now a professor of social policy, law, and women's studies at Brandeis University, and she joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, your first thoughts when you heard about Sandra Day O'Connor's announcement of her retirement?
Well, in fact, it was a reminder of the summer of 1991. And my thoughts really were that I hope that it wasn't going to be as tense a summer, that it wasn't going to be as acrimonious as the summer of 1991 was.
Do you really need to be reminded? Are you not constantly thinking about 91? Because I know at one time you were.
Well, it's always back there, but I don't think of it constantly.
Right, it's not foreground, it's background.
It's background.
You didn't voluntarily come forward with your accusations about Clarence Thomas. You were watching from the sidelines after Clarence Thomas was nominated and thought surely you would be called.
Well, I did think I would be called because anyone who's followed these proceedings know there is a really intense background check of the nominees. And they include people who live in their neighborhoods. They include people who they've worked with over the years. And so I was certain that I would be called. In fact, I was called by a Washington Post journalist about my opinion of the nominee before the Senate called me.
And then you spend weeks, once you are called, sort of negotiating as to how you might come forward. What's that process like?
Well, that process is like no other process that I could have imagined for the way I would spend my summer. I was talking to friends. I was actually talking to one attorney who had some experience with sexual harassment. I was just really weighing the situation, trying to figure out what was going on and how, in fact, to approach the committee, because there is no clear process for an individual who wants to come forward with this kind of information. One of the things I think we have to be careful about as this nomination goes forward this time is that we don't create such acrimony and such hostility in the process that we really turn off witnesses who would come forward and who have valuable information.
Well, I was going to say, you become a reminder of that beware, no matter what your charges are about someone, you know, how much you're going to be raked over the coals.
Well, I am a reminder, and I don't know whether that would encourage someone to come forward to realize that, you know, you can be an important part of this process. Or in some cases, perhaps it would discourage people.
Remind us, how, once you got into the hearing, once you got before the Senate committee, how tough was it?
It was, I'm not even sure I can capture it now, some 14 years later, how difficult it was. You just sort of were subject at any moment to personal attacks, professional attacks.
What did they say?
Oh, accusations that I was lying, accusations that I was suffering from a mental disorder, accusations that I had was a spurned lover, accusations that I was somehow trying to promote my own self and my own career by coming forward.
Senator Danforth on the committee is the one who consulted a forensic psychiatrist, Dr. Dietz, to support this theory that you suffered from erotomania. He, by the way, is the doctor who testified most recently in the case of the Texas mother who was accused of drowning her children. The verdict in that case was overturned because he gave false testimony. He's one of the people who either spoke out against you or whose words were used against you that you actually contacted afterwards. What did you say to him? What did you want to know from him?
What I really wanted to know was, what was the objective of the senators in contacting him? Why was he called? What were they trying to show? What were their motives in contacting him and then using this theory to at least persuade the public that somehow I was mentally disturbed? The way they contrived the theory to fit my situation was that I had somehow imagined the whole thing. I had imagined that Thomas had some sexual interest in me, and then that imagination had taken hold and led to my swearing under oath to it. If you look at the condition of erotomania, what you find is that someone who is suffering from this kind of delusion actually thinks that they are, in fact, having a relationship with the person that is the object. It's not something that a person imagines that they have been subjected to harassment. So it didn't fit in any form or fashion.
And yet it was used in the testimony.
But it was used in the testimony. Senator Danforth actually, I think, gave a press conference. But I think one of the things, maybe the positive thing, that something like that allegation did was to show how ignorant we were about the issue of sexual harassment. And so, in a way, in a very negative and way, that might have caused people to pay attention to the issue and to try to discern what sexual harassment was and wasn't.
And by the way, Dietz told you that he hadn't been asked by Republican senators how to tell the difference between someone who's delusional and someone who's been sexually harassed. But I want to ask you, why do you think more Democrats didn't support you at that time? I'm wondering if one of the answers is that there were a lot of male Democrats uneasy about accusations that might be flung at them.
Well, I think you're right. This was not a partisan issue. This was a gender issue. And I think part of the reason that it didn't play very well in Washington, or it just sort of got confused in the heat of this, was that the press in particular was really looking for partisan issues. They really weren't looking for real life issues. Mm. Once the smoke of the hearing sort of cleared, people understood it as a real life issue.
Anita Hill, now a professor of law at Brandeis University. She testified against her former supervisor, Clarence Thomas, in 1991 and was considered a hero by many for bringing sexual harassment into the national dialogue. But as we said, she was also vilified, and she's had some vindication on that count. And we're going to hear more about that. Also, more on her thoughts on the process to replace Sandra Day O'Connor. More coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're talking to Anita Hill, law professor at Brandeis University. She testified against now Supreme Court Justice Thomas Clarence, but a nominee in 1991. And Professor Hill, you've had some vindication. I'm thinking about then uber conservative David Brock. He wrote the 1993 book, The Real Anita Hill, The Untold Story. He said that you were the one who liked to watch pornography, that you sprinkled pubic hair in students' papers, that you were a little bit nutty and a little bit slutty. Then in 2000, 2002, he had a conversion. He took it all back. He wrote Blinded by the Right, The Conscience of an Ex-Conservative, and said, "Your testimony was actually more truthful than Thomas's." What was your reaction?
Well, I had learned long ago not to be defined by David Brock or any of the detractors. It was interesting in that it happened. It's a long way in terms of 9 years, but, you know, some people go their lifetimes without having the person who has been one of the chief detractors actually recant. So I felt pretty good to only have to wait those 9 years. I think what you have to keep in mind in terms of what Brock is saying is that there really was a lot of poison in the air during those hearings. And that's the kind of thing that I think we really have to try to avoid as we go into this summer.
Well, let's ask you a little bit about the process ahead and what's to come and the idea of replacing Sandra Day O'Connor. Do you think that it has to be a woman?
No, I don't think it has to be a woman. But I also think that it's very important that we look at individuals who really have a respect for gender equality. Mm. In many gender cases, there have been 5-4 splits. And Sandra Day O'Connor was in the majority casting the 5th vote.
Tilting the case. Mm-hmm. Going back to Justice Clarence Thomas, in the end, he's on the bench for life. And his name is bandied about as a potential successor for Chief Justice Rehnquist when he retires as expected. Your thoughts on that?
I think a Thomas nomination as Chief Justice would be so divisive and would make so many people lose confidence all over again in the U.S. Supreme Court. We do have 9 members of the court, and there is some balance in terms of how he votes and what his impact will be. But once you put someone in a leadership position, you are really giving an indication that this person really is sort of the golden standard for the entire court. And that shouldn't be in the case of Thomas.
How do you think he has been as a justice?
I don't think that there's anyone who suggests that he's had an outstanding record as a justice. Early on, there were criticism of him because he really seemed to be in lockstep with Justice Scalia. In addition, there were criticisms because he rarely spoke on the bench during oral argument.
But as you know, supporters of Clarence Thomas have said he's a strong upholder of the Constitution as it's originally written, and President Bush has called Thomas, along with Antonin Scalia, his favorite justice.
That may be, but I think when President Bush says that he's his favorite justice, he's really talking about ideology. He's not talking about the content of his opinions or his reasoning.
You've spoken to people like Senator Alan Simpson, who, you know, excoriated you during the hearings in 91, but he claimed that he was getting letters over the transom, right? I've got letters hanging out of my pocket. I've got faxes from people saying, watch out for this woman. But nobody's got the guts to say that because it gets tangled up in this sexual harassment crap. Again, that's Senator Alan Simpson during the hearings in 91. I'm wondering, have you ever spoken to Clarence Thomas?
Oh, no, I've never spoken to Clarence Thomas. And I think the most egregious part of that Simpson statement, of course, I was personally offended that he says that, you know, people are saying, watch out for me. But I think I was even more offended by his conclusion that, you know, the whole charges about sexual harassment were crap. Mm. But in terms of talking to Clarence Thomas, I haven't had any desire or opportunity to talk with him. I know what my experience was, and I stand by that experience, and I stand by my testimony in 1991, and will continue to. I've said it all. I said it there.
Do you regret that you said it?
No. I try not to live life with regrets. I regret that, in fact, the situation was reduced to what it was, and much of the anger that got expressed and the allegations that were hurled I regret that, and I regret the hurt that it caused a lot of people who I care about.
Such as?
Well, friends whose jobs were threatened, whose jobs were made harder.
Well, given all of this, that those were your regrets, that there are people who were hurt in this, what would you say to somebody as we gear up for another confirmation hearing who's considering potentially coming forward about one of the nominees?
Well, I hope nobody is really in a position of having to come forward with the same kind of information that I had to come forward with. But I would say to them, in the end, it is the right thing to do. It doesn't mean it's going to be easy, and it doesn't mean that the outcome that you would like to see is what's going to occur. But in the end, in terms of the importance of the court and the importance of this process and the integrity of the process, it's important and it's critical, and you should come forward.
Professor Anita Hill, she teaches social policy, law, and women's studies at Brandeis University. I'm just wondering, given that, what are young girls, do the students come and is this a vibrant thing for them, or is it ancient history? I mean, how do they ask you about it?
Well, some of the young women at the university really understand it and they appreciate it. And I have to say, many of the young men do as well. Mm. But when I teach my class, you know, we can't talk about me for the entire semester. I use that really as a starting point about who I am,
yeah,
and what my experience has been. But then we move on.
Anita Hill, again, professor of social policy, law, and women's studies at Brandeis University, also the author of Speaking Truth to Power. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
And stay with us. Much more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
The International Olympic Committee has the honor of announcing that the Games of the 30th Olympiad in 2012 are awarded to the city of London.
And London wins in an upset. In Singapore today, the International Olympic Committee chose London over what many thought was the favorite, Paris, to host the 2012 Summer Olympics. Crowds in London's Trafalgar Square were apparently as startled as anyone. Well, joining us from London here now is Michael Goldfarb. Michael, you were in Trafalgar Square at the moment that announcement came over the loudspeaker, sounds like with many of your best friends. What was it like there?
Well, you know, Robin, you know how it is when you really, really want something, but you don't really expect to get it, and then they say, you've got it. It was a nanosecond where everybody looked at each other. Did we hear right? And then and then chaos. It was really something to melt the coolest, most phlegmatic English heart, this announcement. And I was standing next to a colleague from Le Monde, and he actually had a moment where I thought he would weep.
Well, how did this happen? I mean, Paris looked so good to everyone as a venue, and now London wins. Why?
Well, it's still not clear. I mean, it was a very close vote. There are 104 members of the IOC who vote on this, and London got 54 votes, and Paris got 50. It was that close. Apparently, in the end, it was the final presentation made by Sebastian Coe, 1500 gold medalist at the Moscow Olympics in 1980. He's now Lord Coe. He's in the House of Lords, and he's just put together a bid that focused very much on tweaking the heartstrings, saying that, you know, he had been inspired as a boy to run in the Olympics, and that this would inspire a generation of youth in multicultural Britain. And it worked, because Paris, up until 6 months ago, everyone assumed it was going to Paris. All the bookies were taking bets on it. And in the end, Paris finishes second for the third time in a row.
Interesting that the multicultural aspect was something that appealed, whereas it's provided some tension in Britain, as we've spoken about before here on the program. And as we know, fewer hotels in London, more expensive compared to Paris.
Absolutely. And I mean, if you look at Paris, I mean, the strength of the Paris bid was almost all of the major facilities are already built. And of course, the Olympic Committee is very concerned after what happened in Athens, where, you know, right up until the game started, it wasn't clear that all the facilities would be finished. Paris has a magnificent public transport system that works and is cheap. London's hasn't had a decent amount of work done on it in 30 years. In the end, they went for what might be rather than what already was.
Well, but as you have pointed out to us, London is quite the hot spot in Europe.
It certainly is. You know, and what's interesting is French President Jacques Chirac flew out to Singapore to make a last-minute appeal and immediately put his foot in his mouth by complaining that British food was the second worst in Europe. The only thing worse was Finnish food. Of course, there were two Finns on the committee that voted on who got the games in the end. And of course, he was being a little bit foolish because, you know, every Friday, if you go to the Gare du Nord in Paris, there are hundreds and then thousands getting on the train to come to London.
Yeah.
Wealthy young Parisians prefer to spend the weekend in London for, among other reasons, the fact that the restaurants are better and the nightlife is actually much cooler.
Jacques Chirac also made a comment about British farming. He said the only thing that Brits contribute to European farming was mad cow disease, which of course didn't go over very well, which points to the ill will between the French leader and Tony Blair, which began with the, you know, the Iraq War. So there's a lot of underpinning to this.
There is. I mean, it's very interesting. The last 90 days have brought Tony Blair and Jacques Chirac into very sharp conflict diplomatically. And of course, they're both now in Gleneagles in Scotland for the G8 summit. It's interesting, they're going to be talking about getting some kind of agreement on global warming, but both of them are willing to burn up irreplaceable fossil fuels to fly from Europe to Singapore to make sure that their capital cities got these Olympic Games. It's a very, very, very interesting time. These two most important political leaders in Europe, and they compete on every political and diplomatic issue. And today they were in stark competition about whose capital would get to stage the 2012 Olympics, and Tony Blair won.
Well, what's next for London?
Well, let's see. What's next for London? We know for a fact that my local property tax is going up 75 cents a week from now until 2012 to pay for the games. There'll be 6 years of disruption, and in fact, on the way back from Trafalgar Square on the underground, the dirty, filthy, always running late underground, I observed an argument. There was a guy coming back from Trafalgar Square with a little pennant saying, "Back the bid, London 2012." And a guy sitting next to him said, "Who won?" He said, "Well, we're going to stage the Olympics." And the fellow who asked the question said, "Oh, that's great. 6 years of cost overruns and delays for a two-week party." And the guy who was waving the banner said, "Well, why don't you move to Paris, mate?"
WBUR's Michael Goldfarb speaking to us from London. He was in Trafalgar Square this morning when Londoners learned they'll be hosting the Olympics in 2012. Michael, thanks for speaking with us.
My pleasure, Robin.
Elected officials from around New England are in Boston today to make the case that military bases in their towns should remain open. Backed by protesters, the town officials will appear before the Base Closure and Realignment Commission, which has the power to overturn the Pentagon plan announced last May to streamline bases. Here now is Fred Tice, joins us now from the Boston Convention Center. And Fred, three bases in New England could be closed: the U.S. Navy submarine base in Connecticut, the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard that straddles Maine and New Hampshire, and Otis Air National Guard Base on Cape Cod. What's the scene there at the convention center?
These hearings are being held in this new convention center, which is vast. So different things are going on. While upstairs, the members of the delegations are making their case, in other parts of the convention center, there are small rallies in support of the bases.
We know that Senator Edward Kennedy is expected to address commission members and plead the case for Otis Air National Guard Base on Cape Cod on the basis of national security?
In part on the basis of national security, of course. On 9/11, two F-15s from Otis were the first planes to get to New York. But the larger argument in favor of keeping Otis open has to do with the Coast Guard. It operates out of Otis and does all the air rescue for, you know, ships in distress at sea, and all the way from New York Harbor to the Canadian border. Cape Cod, because it sticks out into the Atlantic Ocean, is regarded by the Coast Guard as an excellent place to fly its helicopters out of, because it can go right out over the ocean. And they would love to stay there, but the Coast Guard doesn't have the budget to run its own air bases. Mm. So the main argument being put forth is that in order to keep the Coast Guard there, they ought to keep Otis Air National Guard Base open.
Well, now this commission must submit its findings to President Bush by September 8th. This might be the only day of hearings in New England, but there will be lobbying, and the commission is traveling around the country having these kinds of hearings in other regions. Any sense of whether or not these pleas might work and some of these bases might be kept open?
The sense I got from speaking to officials on Cape Cod is that the BRAC is listening to their arguments very carefully today, Governor Romney of Massachusetts, said that he was pretty confident that he was going to be able to keep Otisera National Guard base open. In the past, Senator Joe Lieberman has said about the base at New London, Connecticut, that there was only a 20% chance of keeping that open.
Here now is Fred Tice speaking to us from Boston's Convention Center. Fred, thanks.
You're very welcome, Robin.
And still to come, adapting Kafka to the stage can be, well, Kafkaesque. As you'll hear, you're listening to Here and Now. Call it the new Cold War. Employees in offices around the country, some huddled under blankets, locked in bitter debates over the thermostat. It seems to get worse in the summer with the mercury rising outside and air conditioners blasting inside. In our office, there seem to be more climate zones than in an African rainforest. The corner where I sit is the Amazon. A few feet over, my colleagues complain of Arctic conditions. What follows? Covert trips to the thermostat, co-workers adjusting the temperatures like kids on a seesaw. It turns out we're not suffering alone. Recent studies show that office temperature is the number one workplace complaint, and room temperature can actually affect productivity and the bottom line. Joining us on the line to talk about the thermostat wars, Don Young of International Facility Management Association in Houston, Texas. His group helps companies create better workplaces. Don, help us. This is terrible. I mean, I just can't tell you how big an issue the thermostat and the temperature is in our office. Are you hearing that?
Yes, exactly, Robin. We have repeated a study over the course of three different years, 1991, 1997, and 2003. All indications are that too hot and too cold are the number one and number two office complaints.
Right. Well, in our office, producer Steph Katsonis once took off his pants and ran around in his boxer shorts because he was so hot, and he's the one that gets hot while the rest of us are freezing. What are people telling you about what they do to cope with the heat or the cold?
People have resorted to wearing woolen mittens, for example, with the fingertips cut off.
So they could type.
They can work the keyboards. People who are in the north and perhaps are deer hunters have used the chemical mitten warmers that hunters use to keep warm and place them in their shoes.
Oh, yes. I understand that one woman told you that she uses her husband's heated hunting seat that he sits on when he goes hunting. She uses that at her office, at her desk.
Exactly. There are it's probably right out of the deer blind. They have products, for example, called lava buns that you can microwave. And it lasts up to 8 hours, and you can sit and be warm the entire day.
I need lava buns. I wear tights under a skirt. People wear their flannel pajama bottoms. They bring in socks. I mean, it seems as if the cold people feel that they have to take the most offensive tactics, but people get hot as well.
Yes, and I think cold is a little more difficult to deal with because people are doing an awful lot of typing. Their hand and their knuckles tend to get sore and
frostbite.
It does affect productivity.
It's exactly. Terrible. In fact, you have done a study. How does it affect productivity when it's too cold in the office?
If it's too cold, productivity stops, slows down.
Aha.
That if the temperature is increased to as high as 77 degrees, productivity can increase as much as 44%.
Well, as a matter of fact, I'm reading that typing errors fall by 150%, and that can gain companies an extra $2 per worker in productivity.
Exactly.
We understand some companies, in order to fool workers into thinking that they're actually controlling the situation, have installed placebo thermostats.
Oftentimes buildings have been renovated or they've been updated and thermostats have just been left on the wall when actually the controls are central. And it's sort of interesting to see people feel like if they can get a temperature reading and move that dial right or left, that it has a placebo effect, gives them a little bit of peace of mind.
What do you tell companies to do to deal with this issue?
One of the key things is to listen to people and to look at the simple solutions first. Some changes can be as easy as taking someone who is too hot and somebody who is too cold, and if they're within the same work area, to simply have them switch places.
And we understand there's technology to create separate thermostats for, you know, a cubicle-by-cubicle basis.
Yes. State-of-the-art is individual controls at individual workstations where temperature can be controlled even throughout the day. If one is sitting by a window in the morning with the eastern exposure, you can increase the cool air. And in the afternoon, as the sun sets to the other side of the building, you can decrease it.
Don Young with International Facility Management Association in Houston, Texas. By the way, what's it like in your cubicle?
Right now, I'm pretty comfortable. It's about 72 degrees, even with 81% humidity on my hygrometer. So I'm staying comfortable today, even with high humidity.
Make another note. Get a hygrometer, whatever that is, because it's freezing here. Don, thank you.
Thank you.
It's getting hot in here, so hot. So take off all your clothes.
Stay with us. More ahead here and now.
So take off all your clothes.
I'm Robin Young. It's here and now. In Franz Kafka's novel America, that's America with a K, the Statue of Liberty holds a sword, a bridge connects New York and Boston, and a 17-year-old immigrant from Germany, Carl Rossmann, discovers a phantasmagorical new world. A new and daring adaptation of the Czech writer's uncompleted first novel is now being staged at the American Repertory Theater in Cambridge.
As he clambered on board, he paused, one foot still in the old world, one already in the new. He'd lost his umbrella, his suitcase, and now the stoker. Carl studied his uncle's face. His uncle avoided his gaze and stared at the waves that swirled around the boat.
The American Rep Theater's adaptation of Franz Kafka's America comes from the mind of the wunderkind of American theater, Gideon Lester. He came to the ART straight out of Oxford University and is associate artistic director and dramaturg. Well, yesterday I spoke with Gideon at the theater and began by asking him, why did he choose to adapt Kafka, especially when he's not a playwright? He's a dramaturg.
In 5 seconds, a dramaturg has two functions. First, as a bridge between a text and a production, and then between a production and an audience. So we're really there to facilitate.
And you essentially, I mean, your own words appear quite a bit in this adaptation.
That's right, and it varies from section to section. There are sections of the adaptation that are more or less taken directly off the page, and Kafka had an incredible sense of play and of fun and a great visual sense as well. And so, in fact, there are some places where we've literally taken descriptions from the novel and used them as stage directions. And then there are places where I had to be much more inventive in the way that I rethought the story.
Well, I guess the larger question is why? Why Kafka's America?
For several reasons. First of all, because he paints very vividly great, wild, extraordinary stories with very colourful characters. And that's what theatre does too. And also because it's very interesting when you think that here was a young man who was 28 years old when he started writing the novel in 1911, who had never been to America and was fantasizing about what this country must be like. And it's great, almost a century later, for us to go and look through the lens of this brilliant, imaginative, crazy young man, the way that he looked at this country with an outsider's eye and with a strong imagination, to see how it measures up.
Hello, I am your English teacher.
Hello.
Apple pie.
Apple pie.
Baseball.
Baseball.
America.
America.
Yes, I like to be in America.
Yes, I like to be in America.
Where do you think, again, going referring to Kafka, who, as you said, never had come to America when he wrote this, where do you think he was right?
Well, I think that he was, first of all, very right about the experience of an immigrant. There's a great deal of longing and desire for stability, for family, for a new world. And he really understood the possibilities of the new world as it still exists. I think he got the American dream absolutely right, in a very hopeful sense. But I think he also understood that the dream has a dark side, and that many, many people who come to the country used to and still do get crushed, and their aspirations lead nowhere, and they literally disappear.
You portray that as a man at the end who literally disappears onto a train.
Right, absolutely. Well, and if, in a way, that's what literally happens at the end of the novel. The book is unfinished, and the final chapter is an incredibly beautiful description of the central character, Carl, getting onto a train that takes him on a journey across America. It says Carl never understood how huge America was. And Kafka never finished the novel. I don't think that he could have finished it. I think that that sense of getting absolutely sucked into the landscape is precisely the way that he wanted this novel to finish.
And, you know, it's precisely what some people say America should do, assimilate people.
That's right. But assimilation always has an upside and a downside. And I feel that very strongly, not only as a foreigner in this country, but also as a Jew in Britain, where my family and many of their friends really have learned how to assimilate completely, disguise themselves to avoid looking too different.
You've also said that you identify as a gay man.
That's right. I mean, I think that you learn after a time that viewing the world with an outsider's eye can be very useful. At times painful, being gay and young, or being Jewish in a culture that can sometimes be quite anti-Semitic, or in the case of coming to America, really giving up my own home and moving into a completely new society for 10 years. But that sense of displacement that all of that brings, I think, is really very useful. It teaches you great life tools.
And here we have Carl, the character at the center of America, going through this experience. With this cast of characters, as I was watching it, I was thinking that some of them, for instance, he comes across some hobos, a Frenchman and an Irishman. I would squint my eyes and think, wow, they look like Disney characters, like the wolf that somebody, Peter, meets on the way or something. You're nodding.
Oh, absolutely. And, of course, Disney, but also the two tramps in Pinocchio, and then also Huck Finn. And I'm absolutely sure that Kafka must have read Huck Finn. The great thing about reading a first novel by a 28-year-old is that he was just voracious. He was eating up the world. He was reading everything. We know, for example, that he'd read Dickens and loved Dickens, and actually read Dickens in English and was very proud of the fact that his English was good enough to do it. And so he just steals wholesale from all of these sources.
I also felt I was seeing early black and white Chaplin films, sort of this sort of post-depression. Tell me you're nodding.
Yes, absolutely. Although we can't absolutely prove it, I think it's pretty clear that by 1923, when Kafka put his pen down and stopped trying to finish the novel, he was already looking at early American films. Also, I should say, the Yiddish theater. So the theatricality of the novel, you could also see coming out of the plays that he saw in the Yiddish theater of Prague.
Carl made me so sad, the character, because as you said, he just gets stomped by this American assembly line, you know. But at times, I mean, it's just so hilarious at times. You know, I don't think hilarity ensues when I think Kafka. Where do you think it came from?
I think it comes from two directions at the same time. First of all, Carl is beautiful because he's naive and he's very wide-eyed. And that's a great way of looking at a new world. And so when you read the book, and I hope when you see the production, you get a very naive sense. He's constantly in a state of amazement at the world. And because he's naive, he's also quite gullible. And that leads to a great deal of humor. Unfortunately, at his expense, he's constantly being tricked by this series of rogues. But also Kafka, and here I think he also is influenced by Dickens, Kafka really was a pioneer in the grotesque. And a great deal of humor in Kafka comes from the fact that everything is amplified. People are huge, they're voracious, their appetites in every sense are enormous. And that too can ultimately become very funny, though disturbing as well.
So here you are, Gideon Lester, superstar of the American theater, comes to us straight from Oxford University at the age of, I think, 12 or something. How old were you, 28?
I suppose I was 24, 25.
And, you know, heir to quite a few crowns here at the American Rep Theater. How do you feel about, how has this process been for you, you know, mounting this huge production? Mixed reviews, as people, you know, give you huge plaudits for a huge attempt, a noble, noble, noble effort. You've said it's a work in progress. What's this process been like? It feels perhaps a little Kafkaesque just to do the thing.
It's been tough. I mean, the process of learning how to represent a strong artistic presence in a rehearsal room is not something that dramaturgs are trained to do. So I've had to learn very quickly to become adept and fast and very assertive as a writer. And in hindsight, I can't believe that we ever decided to take on this project. I'm thrilled that we did, but it's been an amazing journey.
Gideon Lester is the Associate Artistic Director of the American Rep Theatre in Cambridge, Massachusetts. His adaptation of Franz Kafka's America is on stage through Sunday. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.